And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Usry, and I'm happy to welcome Chanel Benz back to the program today. Chanel was on the program to talk about her first book, the short story collection, The Man Who Shot Out My Eye Is Dead, which won the 2018 Sergio Troncoso Award for Best First Fiction and the Philosophical Society of Texas 2018 Book Award for Fiction. Today we'll be talking about her new novel, The Gone Dead, which is published by Echo HarperCollins. Chanel, as the book opens, it's 2003, and Billy James returns to Greendale in the Mississippi Delta. Why has she been away for 30 years?
You know, she didn't grow up in the Delta. She came to visit her father as a small child, and now she's, you know, inherited this house, so she's come back. So it's very much, you know, a stranger comes to town and probably barely remembers being there.
Her father did pass away while she was there 30 years ago when she was only 4 years old, and her mother never talked much about her father's death. What did she know in those 30 years about what had happened?
I think that he had had a fall, that there was an accident, that it was just kind of this tragic thing. And I think that's it. And I think that when we've heard stories our whole lives, it's not until we're adults, it's not until I think something else happens that we sort of question, you know, wait a second, there are all these holes, or actually this story doesn't make sense, or this is a, you know, a terrifying story. I can remember my grandmother, who was Irish, was one of nine, of course, and a twin. And she was always telling this story about her sister, Aggie. And whenever she mentioned her, it was like, people were always saying like, oh, go and get Aggie down from the river before she throws herself in. But it was always like these suicide attempts. And it was only until I was an adult and I'm like, why are we always getting Aggie out of the river? Like, why is she always going to throw herself off the cliff? And realizing like, oh, there's a story there. And so I think her father's passing is more serious in this way, but I think we don't necessarily question some of these sort of family mythologies.
I know for certain myself, because I took one of those 23andMe genetic tests and found out that my family background was not nearly what I thought it was.
Yeah, there's no more secrets now. I've heard so many, you know, discovered siblings and, you know, discovered cousins. And I did Ancestry.com, and there's definitely some surprises. Even just things that cousins who are slightly older than me can tell me about myself. One of my second cousins got in touch with me, and he was trying to figure out our connection, and it's through my father's family. And then he said, wait a second, I've met you. We met when you were 3 and I was 10. And he had this whole story. And so, you know, I love that kind of thing.
Did that experience help inform you how Billy approached her family back in Mississippi and the memories that she doesn't have of them knowing each other?
Well, it happened very recently, so it was sort of after the book was finished. I almost feel, in a kind of mystical way, as if I've been like calling these experiences to me. You know, as I was working on the book, and pretty deep into the book, like my own father, after many years, got back in touch with me. I don't think we'd spoken for, I don't know, 18 years. I think that, yeah, that I have a lot of questions about my own childhood, and that definitely informed the kind of mystery that's at the heart of the book.
What were the particular circumstances that led her to come back to Greendale at this time?
Her grandmother on her mother's side passes, and so she inherits this, basically it's a sharecropper shack and a little piece of land that her father once owned. So, you know, when she was 4 and he died, it went to her mother, and then her mother passed when she was, I think, 19, and then it passed to her grandmother, and now it's finally passed to her. So I think it's curiosity, seeing what she owns. And I think, you know, she is a character who often seeks escape. So I think that's part of it too.
So why did you choose 2003 for the main part of the action?
I wanted it to be pre-Katrina because Katrina did affect the Delta. People did move up from New Orleans to the Delta. And I didn't necessarily want that to be part of the story. I also wanted it to be set in a time where, because it deals with civil rights era and civil rights era cold cases, I wanted it to be a time where reasonably possible witnesses or accessories or perpetrators would still be alive and somewhat vibrant. And I wanted it also to be before the Emmett Till Act, when the FBI technically could start solving some of these civil rights era cold cases, even though it doesn't seem like they really made that happen.
Now, her mother was an academic, studied medieval history, and many academics live peripatetic lives. So has Billy ever really known a home, as in a place?
She's coming from Philadelphia. I think that's the place she spent the most time. But I don't think so. I think that you know, because they were moving around so much, she moved around so much as a child. And when they finally did settle in a place in Philadelphia, her mother passes not long after, and she does stay there. But I'm not sure she has enough community for that place to feel like home. So I think she is somebody who doesn't necessarily feel at home anywhere.
And it's a theme that comes up a couple of times in the book, especially for the African-American characters in the book, some who move away but feel the draw back to home, even though it's a place that has been very unkind to their people over the centuries.
Yeah, and I found that true visiting the Delta, the Mississippi Delta, and I teach a course there too where I bring my students there for a week. And, you know, because we've learned all this history, because we've read all this literature and listened to all this music, a lot of them are wondering, why do Black folks stay in the Delta? And it's hard, I think, maybe for this particular generation to wrap their minds around that idea of home or, you know, living so close to close-knit family or the land. But when they're there and when they're talking to people, they really begin to lock into that concept.
Her guide in this area is her father's younger brother, her Uncle Dee, and he is pretty straightforward with warning her that it's not a safe place generally to be.
Yeah. You know, Dee is a character that just walked on the page, like right away, unlike some of the other characters, which took me some time to excavate or build. I wanted there to be multiple perspectives. I wanted there to be people that love the Delta, that will never leave the Delta. I wanted there to be people who have left, who maybe have some mixed or bitter feelings. And I wanted him to have that complexity, you know, to be somebody who always stays close and kind of keeps coming back himself, but wants the best for Billy, but also does not really have any interest or does not want to go back to the past, does not want to revisit these events.
So it's especially ironic that he has been appointed the literary executor of his brother Clifford's estate.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think it just kind of fell to him rather than anyone thinking that he would be the best person for this job.
Most of her family has left the area, but a cousin of hers, Lola, comes down from Memphis, and we get to see her point of view. We have close points of view on several characters throughout the book.
I had a hard time finding the protagonist's voice, which kind of is unusual from my writing. Usually the voice comes right away, but I had a hard time finding Billy's voice. I think because it is stripped down, it's sort of more transparent, more what we would call sort of like lyrical realism. But I don't really think I kind of cracked her perspective open until I realized that the book needed these multiple narratives. It always had multiple narratives, but not in this kind of like the town, the community. And when I started really working on Dee's voice and Lola's voice and Carlotta's voice and these other characters, then Billy's perspective really came through. And I think I wanted there to be a friendly voice in there, I didn't want, it is a kind of dark atmosphere in a way. I didn't want, everybody be twiddling their mustaches. You know, I wanted somebody to be glad to see her and welcoming and closer to her in age and that they could kind of, have this sort of banter.
While Lola is in fairly good spirits, she's having problems in a romantic relationship back home in Memphis, too.
Yeah, and I wanted to make sure that these characters were not just there to serve Billy, to serve my protagonist, but that they also have their own arc, their own issues, their own things that they're working through. I think a lot of people can relate to the debt that she's struggling with.
The action of the book mainly takes place in the present tense, which has become more common over the years, but it's still not pervasive. Why did you choose that approach for the meat of the story?
I tried all the other tenses, but also I wanted there to be a lot of velocity in the story. I wanted us to feel as the reader that it was happening and that it was happening in real time to Billy so that we could be experiencing it with her and with these characters. And so that, adds to a kind of urgency. But also because I didn't want her reactions and other characters' reactions to be already formed. I want them to be sort of grappling, like, what does it mean now that this piece of unresolved past has floated back into my present, and actually, did it ever really leave? So I wanted us to, when we're in these close thirds with some of the other characters, I wanted us to feel the humanity of moral ambiguity, so that we couldn't just write off some of the characters who have made horrible decisions in the past.
But there are a few times where characters think about the past, and it does slip into the past tense there, and it happens so naturally in the flow of a scene that it is an indicator that we've gone to a memory and we're not in the current action as well.
Yeah.
Her mother was a medieval scholar. Why did you pick that profession for her mom?
For purely selfish reasons. I'm just interested in the medieval era. So it was a way to work out my own obsessions. I think maybe subconsciously, the medieval era is this time where the majority of the population, their bodies were tied to the land because of serfdom. And they do have a very close relationship to the land. You know, I think when we think of the medieval era, we think of kings and queens, but that's sort of the 1%. And most of us came from peasants or, you know, serfs. And so I think there were some connections that subconsciously I was making with, you know, the medieval era and the Mississippi Delta and just this kind of place that's outside of time. You know, the medieval era is this time where people were also very, there was a lot of like localism, you know what I mean? So people were very in touch with what was going on in their town, and things about the outside world were sort of more fantastical. But there are things that happen in the medieval era that do, you know, the Magna Carta or things like that, that do lead to the questioning that eventually becomes about, you know, the individual and rights, the pursuit of happiness and these kind of things. But there's only just kind of the seeds there. And I do see parallels with that and sort of the Jim Crow era, where people have been subjugated for so long, even coming out of slavery. You know, you have the sharecropping system, which is like another kind of slavery. You have the convict leasing system. And then after World War One, but definitely World War II, you have these black soldiers coming back who have had a taste of the other world, who are like, I've gotten to feel what it's like not to be treated like a second or third class citizen. I've gotten to feel what it's like to be just treated as a human, a man, and I can't go back. You know, so you get the rise of the NAACP and these other groups and Deacons for Defense. And so I think it is like there's ties with the medieval era and this sort of the era of segregation and Jim Crow.
Yeah, because you definitely see the rise in terroristic violence from white supremacy after the wars. Lynchings go up immediately after World War One.
Yeah.
And then, of course, all the violence with the Klan and the CCC down in Mississippi after World War II.
Yeah, there's definitely a backlash that I think definitely is not discussed enough, definitely is not well known. And that's the same with, you know, after Reconstruction, there's a backlash that is called, you know, quote unquote, redemption. And that's the white backlash to Reconstruction. That's when you get the KKK. That's when you get these draconian laws. That's when you get this kind of like lynching violence to try to undo everything, all the gains of Reconstruction. People get massacred. It's an incredibly violent time, but it's not something that we really talk about. And in a way, maybe that's what's happening in the present moment, you know, this kind of backlash to some progressive moves that were made in the Obama administration, which all comes from fear.
Well, the book does deal with some very serious themes. It's not dour.
Okay.
There are notes of comedy, and one that made me laugh particularly was that since her mother was a scholar, she didn't care much about the contemporary culture of her time and didn't understand the beauty of Leif Garrett.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's also part of the kind of that Billy wasn't shaped in the way that a lot of other people were, because her mother was so immersed in the medieval period that she sort of spent more time learning about that than what else is going on in her own time.
Could you give us a translation to the Petrarch epigraph at the beginning of the book?
Oh, yeah. It's I think it's something like the sweetness of the world was but a dream.
OK.
Yeah.
Because I'll have to say my medieval Italian sounds great.
Yeah, it's from one of the first sonnets of his Canzonieri, so rhyme sparse. And Petrarch is the kind of the father of humanism. He was the first sort of poet laureate. He would have been somebody that her mother knew well. And he wrote rhyme sparse, sort of translates to my scattered rhymes. He wrote it, I think, during and right after the Black Death. So this time when it seemed like the end of the world.
There's another thing that Billy has inherited, and that's a dog.
So her grandmother had a dog. She has inherited the dog. She is not a particularly a dog person. You know, she never had a chance to have an animal. I think she does mention having a goldfish that didn't last long. And so this is her companion. And, you know, people who've never had animals, like, it takes a while to understand how to communicate with them. I didn't want her to be out alone there. And I think she was kind of wise enough to know that when you go out to the Delta, you're out there in a shack, you probably need a gun and a dog. Or at least that's what she's been told. And so, you know, this is her kind of protector and her companion, a creature that she has to take care of as well. And I think for somebody who's so solitary, it's kind of a move for her to have to, like, worry and care for this other.
She wants to understand her father and the circumstances of his death 30 years ago. So why does she go see Jerry Hobson when she gets there?
I believe that her uncle mentions him. When she asks, you know, who's around that was friends with him, that knew him, she wants to talk to those people. Jerry Hobson is somebody who still lives in town that was married to a woman who was close to her father, who has recently passed, Sheila. And so she kind of hunts him down as really, you know, the only lead she has, the only name she really gets, and goes to sort of pry out any information about her father that she can get.
He lets slip a little detail of that scene from when her father passed away that she had no knowledge of whatsoever.
Yes, that the night her father died, she also went missing. You know, I think that sometimes we discover as adults that certain things have been kept from us that have happened to us because our families find them unpleasant to talk about, because they don't want to revisit it themselves, because I think it just gets sort of tucked away after all these years. And so I think that, you know, it happened when she was 4. No one really wanted to talk about it. It all turned out, quote unquote, okay. But I think when you learn these kind of devastating things about yourself that you can't remember, it's sort of like, well, how much has this shaped me? Because we know now that everything that happens to you shapes you, even when you're a baby, even if you can't remember. And that is one of the questions I'm asking. How much can something that you don't really remember shape you and is sort of working as an unconscious force? And also, now that she's been told about this, can she remember anything?
Because 3 or 4 years old, that's about the cusp of where we actually start to keep long-term memories.
Mm-hmm. It also kind of goes back to that mythology of self. Like, your family tells you stories of things that you did or said or happened to you when you were 3 or 4. And so you have often like a visual narrative accompanying that. But then you ask yourself, wait, is that the memory or is that the story? And or is that a combination of the two? And how much is actually happened and how much have I, after all these years, kind of shaped that narrative to fit who I think I am?
Her closest neighbor out there is the McGee family, and her family has a long and imbalanced history of power with the McGee family.
Which, from my experience of being in the Delta, is not uncommon. You know, if you have typically a white family that owned, for many generations, a large piece of land, well then a lot of the black families who lived there or still live there were either sharecroppers or farmhands or domestic workers. And if the plantation had tenant shacks, then they lived there. So I think what a lot of people who aren't from the Delta don't necessarily realize about the history of the Delta is you have these really intimate relationships. You know, people who have grown up together, people who have played as children together, women who have taken care of children. But of course, there are all of these social binds that have kept people separate, and of course, economic circumstances that have kept people separate. And so I wanted that to definitely be an element of the book. And, you know, the McGees used to own the land that she has inherited, and they knew her family better than she does.
We see throughout the course of the book that there is the lie that so many of us, especially white Southerners, try to tell ourselves that racism ended the Civil Rights era.
Well, that's what we're taught, to be fair. That's what everyone's taught. I don't even know if when I was in high school, if we even made it to the Civil Rights era. Well, I guess, you know, I just remember we did World War II. I think we skipped right up to the Vietnam War and we didn't learn that much about it. It was just kind of like this happened. And, you know, here's beautiful Martin Luther King, the end. And that was in Northern Virginia, which I think was comparatively progressive to some places. But yeah, there's a lot of mythology about that, false mythology, that makes people, particularly white Americans, comfortable. Because then you can say things like, well, what are you complaining about? Slavery happened hundreds of years ago. I didn't enslave anybody. These kind of things. which ignores segregation and Jim Crow and other institutional discriminations. And I think, yeah, that's why Martin Luther King has been sanitized in the way that he has, because then he can be held up as this figure who sort of ended, you know, ended everything and got the vote and everything's fine now. So now you can vote. So now what are you complaining about? But what happened, particularly in the Delta, is Black people were able to vote, but they had no economic power, because you have things like white flight. You know, you have the people that had the money in the Delta still have the money in the Delta. And in fact, they're, you know, it's an even smaller group. And that getting the vote, as monumental and fantastic as that is not the same thing as reconciliation or healing. And again, there's another kind of, now that I think about it, another kind of backlash, right? That you get, you know, all of these housing laws that discriminate, redlining, Black people not being able to get a loan. You know what I mean? Like, you get all these things put into place. It might not be getting lynched, but it's another kind of discrimination that causes a lot of pain. You know, areas get ghettoized. And so I also think that that's like a harder history to articulate. And even though we're living in this, as people like to say, racially charged time, I am pleased to see that we're talking about these things, that it's entered the national conversation, that we have these Black intellectuals or other intellectuals or historians, like, really informing us and letting us know there's actually, you know, people are coming out with these books. And it's just, I feel personally that I'm able to put facts and history and language to the things that I kind of knew were a problem, but I was never able to articulate.
We've talked about her father a little bit, and we only know about his role as a father, what we've said. But, you know, of course, he was a brother, he was a son, he was a husband, but he was also a notable poet of his time. And in his poetry, he was examining these things.
I mean, he was notable, I think, you know, in terms of being like a poet's poet, but he's definitely somebody who has long been forgotten. And I'm particularly interested in figures and people who have been silenced or omitted or forgotten. You know, recently in The New Yorker, there was that profile on Rhiannon Giddens, and it talks about kind of the seminal Black fiddle player or banjo player. I can't remember. Banjo, I guess. She plays the banjo?
She was in the Carolina Chocolate Drops.
Yeah.
Right.
And that he was this huge antebellum figure, that he was like the person for white people and Black people. And he's just been erased. And by doing that, it's just sort of like you've also erased this connection between African Americans and the Appalachian music tradition and folk music, which is actually like goes very deep. You know, I thought about some of these figures who, because of the color of their skin, because of the constraints of their time, a lot of times because they were women or, you know, because of the sort of economic position they come out of, have been forgotten or erased. And I do feel like I wanted to create a character for whom this had happened.
But there is someone that still has a keen interest in Cliff James poetry, and that's Dr. Melvin Hurley.
Yeah, I sort of wondered if I went too far with this character, but he is a scholar. He is basically the scholar of her father, Cliff James. And so, you know, he's kind of been occupying this lonely role for a while of being a Cliff James expert. And so, you know, she invites him to come and sort of help her with these things. And he is delighted. But of course, he's very bound up with his own sort of anxieties and things like that.
They have a lot of common goals, but their motivations are very different.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they both want to discover as much as they can about her father. But, you know, he's thinking about publications, he's thinking about the conferences that he's going to do, you know, he's, as somebody who has probably been snubbed for a very long time, he's thinking how this will, like, jettison him into, you know, that sort of scholarly glory, finally, at last. And so, you know, he is definitely an ally, but I also wanted to make sure he was complicated.
Avalon comes up in the story, and Avalon is not only a place of legend, it's a real place mm-hmm. in the story.
Yeah, so Avalon is the juke joint that her father frequented, and I think everybody in the town did. Most of those places are obsolete. When I was going through the Delta, there's so many forgotten, sort of abandoned structures that have become part of the landscape, that have become part of the land. And I think it adds to the sense that history, that the past has not left this place.
Because you do give it a voice.
Yes. I do give it a voice. And that just kind of came to me in one go. Some people are like, well, is it going to talk again? And I was like, it's that all it's going to say.
So since you do go down to the Delta, what's the difference between a juke joint and the club?
So a club is like a modern place, you know, that's going to have modern music, hip hop, rap. And the juke joint, you know, is going to have some live music. It's going to, you know, have a jukebox. Usually they don't necessarily serve liquor. It might just be like, you know, some beer. You know, it comes from the kind of like house parties, really. And a lot of the juke joints that existed were somebody's house, you know, like Po Monkeys, where it's his house, but on Thursday nights it's the juke joint. And so it's this place of like release. It's this place for Black folks in the Delta that's away from the eyes of the white folks. You know, after backbreaking work on the plantation or in a white family's house, you can come to this place and just let loose. And so I think it's a safe space.
Turning to your work, we talked first about your short story collections a couple of years ago. What was it like transitioning to writing a full-length novel from that?
It was very hard for me. I mean, I'm not the kind of writer who likes to picture myself up in some garret clutching my hair and pulling it out. I just try to accept the fact that writing is challenging, try to think of it sort of like a jigsaw puzzle, you know what I mean? Like, you're trying to figure out where the pieces go, you're even cutting the pieces yourself, and that you have to go through different kind of structures and configurations, and that frustration is part of it, but that it's a game. You know, you're playing. It's serious play. But I do find the short story form a lot easier. Part of that is getting to sketch out something very quickly and getting to see the whole thing and know sort of like what this is about, where I'm going, how I might want to play with the form. And with this book, I just kept kind of backing up and redoing the first, you know, 25, 50 pages, which I don't recommend. You know, the short story form is a lot about velocity. It's a lot about getting to the heightened moment quickly with the most energy, unpredictably, but you want your readers to feel like it was the most exciting trajectory, but it was also whatever you end at, it's inevitable and authentic. Whereas with the novel, you really need to do a lot more backstory, really stretch out these secondary narratives. You know, it's not just like one straight shot. And so you just have to really root down in the world a lot more. You can't sort of do it with these quick sketches. You really have to flesh those things out. You really have to know your secondary characters. You really have to have some other kind of competing arc. And so because I'm somebody who also tends to cut words and try to be very concise, there were moments where I was like, it's like squeezing blood from a stone. Like, can I make this book any longer? I had an idea of what I wanted the end to be, but I had no idea how I was going to get there. And it did take me a while.
Did having the multiple points of view help the transition?
Yeah, it definitely did, because I had these other arcs. And also because having multiple points of view takes a lot of weight off of that protagonist. Because if you only have one character, especially, you know, Billy isn't a close third person, but then that character has to do all the telling, a lot of the showing about themselves. Whereas if you have other people talking about the character, like with my students, I like to talk about a character in The Wire, Brother Mazzone. I don't know if you're familiar.
I haven't watched it, but I did interview Benjamin Bush, who was an actor on the
So on there's the show. This assassin character, Brother Mazzone, who two of the kind of heads of the gang are going to get to come and like take care of their problem, which I can barely remember what it is. So they're sitting in a room, this man and this woman, Stringer Bell, who's Idris Elba, and this actress who's great, and I can't remember her name. And she says about the real leader who's in jail, she says, Avon's going to call Brother Mazzone. And the guy who's playing Stringer Bell just sits back and he goes, Brother Mazzone? And she's like, mm-hmm, Brother Mazzone. And that's what they just say back and forth for a while. But then you get these other like little snippets of scenes where people are like, I heard Brother Mazzone's coming. You know what I mean? And so it's kind of, it almost feels like a musical, like Brother Mazzone, Brother Mazzone. And so when you finally get this character, you already have this built up like mythology, and he hasn't had to do any work. And when he appears, he's wearing a suit, a bow tie, glasses. He has an assistant that's constantly giving him like the latest Harper's magazine. And he just kind of comes out of his car and sits on the bench and starts to read this magazine. And so you have this built up mythology, but you also get to do something unpredictable by presenting this character completely unlike the kind of built up mythology of what we think we're going to receive. And so I think when you have multiple perspectives, it's like other people can say things about Billy. She can either support that by whatever she says and does, or she can kind of flip that on its head. And what you're getting is just other people's perspective of her and how people might be sort of allying against her or with her. And I just also think because she is a stranger to the Delta, there are things she can't know and things she'll never know. And so it's also a way to kind of deliver more of the narrative in a way to me that felt realistic.
Now for you, what do you know now about writing a novel that you wish you would have known when you started?
Oh, Lord. I think the number one thing that comes to mind is that when you're writing a first draft, to not be careful, to not worry about what I know and don't know, you know, research-wise or historically, where I think it might go, just to really... don't be careful, don't watch yourself, just write. I think then you kind of get the mess of your ideas on the page and you can really see what you've got. And it's not too difficult to go back and re-examine scenes once you've done some research or once you realize like, well, this section isn't working. But I did spend way too much time like re-examining and rewriting those first 25, 50 pages. And I think, yeah, next time I could probably cut through a year or two of work.
So in your travels through the Delta, what has surprised you most about the Delta? What type of thing did you just not have any idea about?
Well, I think as someone coming from the East Coast, I had certain misconceptions about people there, you know. And so when I was writing some of these first scenes, when Billy is encountering people who are not interested in her revisiting the past, that I had them being rude or mean or abrasive. And typically that's not what you're going to get. Even if people don't want her to be there, they're probably going to invite her in for a sweet tea. You know what I mean? Like, they're probably going to ask her about herself. And so I think like I had to kind of like sit with that culture and think about, you know, what does that mean that people would invite her in, that they would offer her these refreshments? Is that kind of just a bless your heart sort of like saccharine kind of bitter moment, or is there something more in there about ideas of like decency and how people want to be perceived? So that was one of the things. And I think I too had to understand like why people don't leave. I mean, there's a lot of reasons why people don't leave. Some people don't leave because they can't. They have no money to pay for security deposit. They have no money to pay for gas. But I also think like they have grown up around their family and they value that. And they can't imagine living in a place or in a town in which they don't have this extended family around them and this support system, which is not something that I grew up with. So I have to really think about what that would be like. And also, it's just, even though there is this, you know, dark history in the Delta, that to me, when I'm there, feels very present, that the Delta is also a place of contradictions and extremes, so that there is joy there. There are people fraternizing. There are people like joking and having fun together that they've just known each other for so long. You know what I mean? And also that, you know, even among Black folks, there still can be this kind of like not wanting to go back to the past, not wanting to remember the past. There can be a conservatism too. And so to make sure that, you know, I was presenting or showing that this exists, that there's, you know, every stripe of person there.
Beyond sociopolitical things, one of the things that strikes me so much is just how far it is between places there and how kind of isolated. And if you want to do anything or see anybody, it is a long way to go.
Yeah. Which I think for some of us, especially who live in a city, is just terrifying. I think for people there, it's freeing. But I also think that does add to those close-knit relationships. Like, you care and know who your closest neighbors are. And that maybe makes you willing to put up with more of their quirks, you know, good or bad. That's just them, you know. And I think also maybe adds to the idea of people helping each other out. Yeah, I definitely wanted the isolation to play a role for somebody like Billy who's not ever really lived in that kind of space.
Well, Chanel, has another idea come for the next book?
Not for my third book.
but your fourth?
No, I mean, I've gone back to writing short stories, which feels, you know, like an amazing relief. And so I've just been working on those right now. I haven't really gotten that third book idea, which is going to kind of swallow me whole. And I'm okay with that. I'm okay with having a little bit of a breather.
Well, we look forward to whatever you can give us next. Thank you so much for coming today.
Thank you.
Chanel Binns is the author of the novel, The Gone Dead, which is published by Echo HarperCollins. I'm Stephen Usry, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WYPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.